From Austin Film Festival and PRI, this is On Story, a look inside the creative process from today's leading writers and filmmakers. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On today's episode, we'll hear from legendary jack-of-all-trades Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans. In 1987, the two co-wrote the groundbreaking comedy Hollywood Shuffle, based on their experience dealing with racial stereotypes of African Americans in the film and television industry.
Because of all these bad experiences, you know, all the shit in Hollywood Shuffle was real. And Keenan was like, let's write it down. And I had saved $60,000 because I had done Streets of Fire. I had done American Flyers with Kevin Costner. And I had saved $60,000. And, you know, everybody was like, are you going to get a Porsche? Are you going to get a Jag? You know, are you going to buy a car? And that's when I said to Keenan, let's make a movie.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry-standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. On today's episode, we'll hear from legendary jack-of-all-trades Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans. In 1987, the two co-wrote the groundbreaking comedy Hollywood Shuffle, based on their experience dealing with racial stereotypes of African Americans in the film and television industry. Robert Rodriguez, writer-director of the El Mariachi trilogy, Sin City, and the Spy Kids franchise, introduced Townsend and Wayans at a lunch honoring them at the 24th Annual Austin Film Festival. Clips from Hollywood Shuffle, courtesy of the Samuel Goldwyn Company. Clips from Meteor Man, courtesy of Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer, Inc.
My name is Robert Rodriguez. These guys in 1987 made a film called Hollywood Shuffle that was a lightning bolt moment for me in filmmaking. I made my movie 4 years later, and I was so inspired by them because, just for process, they shot without permits, wore UCLA t-shirts to make it look like they were learning students, ran up their credit card bill to make a movie that was visionary and really inspired the kind of content that I would continue to do, and inspired that they would go and comment. That film, if you've ever seen it, it's very funny, about an actor tired of getting African-American stereotypical roles and taking on Hollywood, and it sheds light on a problem for the first time, and it's 87 to show how long it took for that to happen. But these guys did it so scrappily and so, and in such an entertaining way that it gave me a vision of my future and purpose and mission. There was a very generous young man who said, I wouldn't be here without Rebel Without a Crew. I definitely would not be here if it wasn't for Robert Townsend and Keenan Ivory Wayans. So I wanted to introduce Robert and say, it's an honor to be sitting next to you.
Multi-talented entertainer Robert Townsend is often referred to as one of the godfathers of the independent film world. For the past 30 years, Townsend has worked in nearly every role in front of and behind the camera, earning the writer, director, and actor over 30 NAACP Image Award nominations. Townsend is best known for creating the films Meteor Man, The Five Heartbeats, and Hollywood Shuffle, which he co-wrote with Keenan Ivory Wayans. Comedian Dave Buckman spoke with Townsend at the 24th Austin Film Festival.
Please welcome Robert Townsend.
Thank you. Thank you.
Ooh, that is quite a body of work.
Thank you.
Yeah. Let's start back in Chicago. You're a kid. You're watching a lot of TV. TV characters are speaking out to you. You're doing impressions of them. What characters, what TV characters were you doing impressions of and were you emulating? Who spoke to you?
You know, when I was a kid, I grew up in a really rough neighborhood on the west side of Chicago. And so when I was 10 years old, my mother was like, you know, she was nervous that I was going to get recruited by one of the gangs. So there was like the Disciples, the Executioners, the Sinister Six, the Vice Lords, all these gangs. And so I would run in the house and all I did was watch TV. And so I watched so much TV that they nicknamed me TV Guide. You know, that was my nickname. It was like, TV Guide, what's on tonight? 7 o'clock, I Love Lucy. 9:30, Mannix. ABC got a better line than NBC. And so I could do... you know, I watched everything on television. And then there was a time that television went off. I mean, like in the olden days, like now, you know, there was a time TV went off. This generation, it's on all the time. But when television went off, if you missed a show, you just missed a show. There was no reruns, there was no DVDs, there was no digital downloads. So my mother, we were on welfare, and so, you know, my mother was looking for work, and so she would miss her shows. And so then she was like, oh, I missed the Hitchcock show, what happened? And I was like, he said this, Mama. They found the body in the alley and discovered that murder does not work. And so I discovered that I could do any character I saw on television. So if it was The Wizard of Oz and the movie came on, I'd be the Scarecrow. Why, I'd have never gotten my brains if it wasn't for you. Why, the square root of one is equal to the pi root of two. The Westerns or Walter Brennan, well, dang, damn it, no bread is fixed. No bread is fixed. I watched everything on television, even the foreign French films. It's just hotel vers tout le mon patois. Woman, why is your tripping? I watched everything. I got discovered in fifth grade, and I'll just tell you this real quick and get back to your questions, but I got discovered in fifth grade because there was a white teacher that wanted kids in the hood to learn about Shakespeare, and his name was James Reed, and he wanted us in fifth grade to read like 3 pages of Shakespeare. And so what happened was I didn't like reading, and Shakespeare looked really hard to me, so I went to the library, and being a kid from the hood, I stole all the Shakespeare records. And, you know, so I went home, and I listened to him on our stereo, Richard III, King Lear, Othello. And when it came time to read, the teacher wanted us to read, and he said, we're going to read it out loud. And so he says, Deborah Jenkins, we're going to read Oedipus today. Deborah Jenkins, you'll be Ophelia. Willie, you're going to be Oedipus. And Robert Townsend, you're going to be Tiresias, the blind prophet. Let's read. Deborah read like a kid normally would read in the hood. Oedipus. You will marry thy mother and killeth thy father, thusly Oedipus. And I had been listening to the Royal Shakespeare Company, so I read it like, Oedipus, I pray not the rage upon thy soul. And the whole class was like, ooh, this is crazy. And so that's kind of how I started as TV guy.
That's great. And then you started doing live productions with Chicago's X-Bag Productions.
I was the youngest member of X-Bag in Chicago. It was the Experimental Black Actors Guild, and I started in the theater there when I was 14. And then I just kind of fell in love with theater, and that's when I saw other people of color writing, directing, producing, and it kind of started to plant seeds in me.
And you moved to New York to do stand-up.
Yes,
you got
with that man back there, Keenan Ivory Wayans.
Yes. I want to ask you what those club days were like. And you actually got a SNL audition in 1980, right?
Yeah, you know, New York was a crazy time because, you know, I was talking about this before. At the Improv back then, it was Robin Williams. It was Rodney Dangerfield. It was Billy Crystal. Jay Leno was the MC. Andy Kaufman. And we were two comedians online trying to audition to get into the Improv. And Keenan was schooling me. And then Keenan left to go back to Tuskegee. He went back to Tuskegee and left me in New York. And then he came back because he was going to be an engineer. And then he was like, he came back and told his parents, you know, that he wasn't going to be an engineer. He was going to be a comedian. They got really upset. And then he was back. He was back. He was like, Rob, they don't love me. You know, Rob, you know, I got to do this shit now. And so he became a regular at the Improv first, and then he schooled me on what to do, and then I became a regular at the Improv. And then the one routine that I had back then was the Shakespeare routine. Like Joe Papp, the famous theater producer in New York City, had done an all-black version of Julius Caesar. And when I went to the show, because I just love theater, some of the people had the language down and some of the people just sounded like they walked in off the street. And so I created this whole routine about Shakespeare, and that became my first routine. But Keenan was the first one to say, hey, Rob, this is how to play the game.
And then the move out to L.A., you just talked a little bit about that road trip out to L.A.
Keenan moves to LA first. He calls me and goes, Rob, they sleeping out here, man. We can make all, we can take care, take advantage of this. We can really do some things. And so then he drives, he flies across country and says, we'll drive your stuff. We'll put all your stuff in a van. And we literally drove back across country. And the rest is his. He tricked me. He, you know, let me tell you something about Keenan. He wanted to see what kind of, what my character was like. So when I went to visit him in the projects, he had his boys going to rob me to see if I was going to run or what I was going to do. True story. But anyway, Keenan, that's the kind of friend he is. He was like, I saw how you handled that, man. I'm really proud. You can really be my friend now. I sent them down. I sent Willie and Fruity and Bobo to rob your ass, and you outsmarted them. So he's the one who got me to L.A. So I was still in New York, happy in New York, doing TV commercials, and I was doing some theater with Woody King and, you know, theater plays, and I was, like, serious auteur. And then when Keenan called and said, man, Rob, you got to get out here, and he was like, you got to get out here. I'll fly back, and we'll drive your stuff. That's what really happened, and that's how I got to L.A.
That's amazing. And you're auditioning out there, and you're getting things, but they're not soul satisfying.
You know, I was having really, you know, really bad auditions. I mean, you know, the churn to become filmmaker started because I was having bad auditions. He's having bad auditions. I was auditioning for Slaves. And, you know, then you auditioned for the basketball player that can't read, you know, all the stereotypes. Willie went to the house. The dude still in the TV, you know, the dude in the interrogation room, that was always my favorite. The dude was so smart. Yeah, the dude you looking for, he on the third floor, man. Yeah, Kojak. Yeah, Ironside. Yeah, Huggy. And it would always be, and I was like, this dude has something, he's like, I know everything. And he'd be always in the pool hall. The dude be in the pool hall. Yeah, man. Dude you looking for, yeah, you looking for Lil Smitty. And Lil Smitty did the whole thing. You want some stock tips? If he knows so much, what the hell is he doing, you know?
That guy's still on TV, by the way.
And then I think Hollywood Shuffle started because I had one of the really, well, we would always share stories on how bad our auditions were. But I had this one audition where there was this white director from England, and he was doing a black exploitation movie, and he was trying to tell me how to be black. No, it's all wrong, it's all wrong, it's all wrong. You said to her, back up, you You're a bad mofo. And I just remember being humiliated. It was one of those auditions, stick your butt out. You know, it's in your walk. Stick it out. Can you make your lips bigger? And I was like, you know, you're as an actor sometimes, you're trying to sell out. She was like, how big do you want them? And I think out of that, with all these bad auditions and everything, I think that's when we were both dying as artists. And then that's when I was saying to Keenan, we should make our own movies. And that's how it kind of started.
Story comes from Loyola Marymount University School of Film and Television, ranked a top 10 film school by USA Today and The Hollywood Reporter, offering graduate degrees in screenwriting, production, and writing and producing for TV. Visit sftv.lmu.edu. Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. We'll be back in a moment. Austin Film Festival's On Story is supported in part by Final Draft, industry standard screenwriting software that now includes extensive story planning tools. Find out more information about Final Draft 10 at finaldraft.com. Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with Hollywood trailblazer Robert Townsend. In 1987, Townsend directed and starred in Hollywood Shuffle. The satire depicted the trials and tribulations of African-American actors in Hollywood, which he and co-writer Kenan Ivory Wayans based on frustrations they experienced auditioning for roles. When we left off, Robert Townsend was discussing the development of the influential film.
Was Hollywood Shuffle the first thing you wrote?
We wrote a picture about a haunted house. That was the first thing we wrote. And then because of all these bad experiences, you know, all the shit in Hollywood Shuffle is real. And Kenan was like, let's write it down. And I had saved $60,000 because I had done Streets of Fire. I had done American Flyers with Kevin Costner. And I had saved $60,000. And, you know, everybody was like, are you going to get a Porsche? Are you going to get a Jag? You know, are you going to buy a car? And that's when I said to Kenan, let's make a movie. And Kenan was like, you didn't go to film school. You never did this, Rob. You don't know any of this. But because we two boys from the hood, we can do anything. And that's when we started to shoot what would be Hollywood Shuffle.
That's amazing. So when you guys were putting it together, was the story there first or were the sketches there first? Which part came first?
It was just four sketches. Black acting school was something that we just came up with and we just thought it was funny to us.
It is. It still is.
You know, we were just like, because they would, you know, like you'd have white producers. No. Say, hey, mama, how's it going? And they would tell us how to do it. And so we just incorporated all that in there. I always love Humphrey Bogart, you know, he was one of my favorites. And I wanted to do a detective in black and white. And so we did Death of the Breakdancer and that Kenan would be Jerry Curl. And then Kenan comes up with all the different wigs. That's when he started thinking stupid stuff. He's like, and then the hair changes again and again and again. And we find all these little wigs. And then we did Sneaking in the Movies because when they would review a black movie, they always gave it a bad review. And I'm like going, we would always say they need different people to review. Like they gave Coolie High a bad review. And I was like, Coolie High is a great movie, or Claudine a bad review. And so then we were like, we need our own critics. And then it says, let's have fun with it and turn it upside down on its head. So we had done those four vignettes. And then, you know, made me think about how we would write, you know, like talking about Hollywood Shuffle, because Kenan, you know, he's in great shape. He's a fitness guy. So it was really hard, you know, to write with him because Kenan would be like, you know, she comes through the door. And then when she comes through the door, and I'm like, dude, I'm like, dude, sit down. No, man, this is how I write. And he's doing push-ups, running around the room, jogging. And that's how he thinks. And it was drive me like the Odd Couple. It would drive me crazy. Like, man, just sit your down. But that's how we started. And then we said, okay, we got the four vignettes. The vignettes came out great. And then we had to sit and think through like real stuff to connect the fibers, like the story of Bobby Taylor. And then that's when we started to really get into learning about being writers and structure and all of that.
One of my favorite scenes in Hollywood Shuffle is the barbershop scene. He goes to see his uncle in the barbershop and he just quit his job. There's so much in that scene. There's a little bit of Meteor Man in that scene. There's a little bit of Five Heartbeats in that scene. A little bit of foreshadowing for your career in that scene. Were those ideas already swimming around your head?
No. I think it was really the beginning of what the possibilities could be, because it takes a lot of courage to say action and cut. So as we started on the journey and we would look at the dailies, it was like, we can really do this. We can really do this. By just touching it, you know, it's like a waterfall starts with a single drop. So we were just being that first drop of like, we can make movies and it's not hard and we can figure it out. And we were in the process of figuring it out. So that, you know, the only thing that I would say is that as you start to touch things, you go like, well, I want to do more of this. And then, you know, it starts to manifest.
Yeah, his uncle tells him, don't let anybody take away your dreams. Who are you talking to? Who is talking to you right there?
In life, you got to be careful who you share your dreams with. My grandmother was the biggest hater in my life. Like when I said, you know, no, that's why she's in Hollywood Shuffle. She goes, you know,
Ellen
like,
Martin.
Now, don't get me wrong. I am happy for Bobby. But I don't want no grandson of mine out there trying to act like a street hustler. Black folks got enough negative images.
So in real life, my grandmother was very negative. You know, like I was like, hey, I wanna be an actor. I wanna pursue. She goes like, what do you know about acting? What do you know about anything about show business? You should get a job at the post office and be a supervisor. You know, there's always work at the post office. And so she was drilling at home, and I would be at her table eating because my mom would be at work, working at the post office. And, you know, my grandmother, I'd be going like, you know, and I stopped sharing my dreams with her because I was like, oh, she's going to kill my dreams. And it's kind of like as artists, we're very vulnerable. So you got to be careful, like, you know, I'm going to be working on. And then it's that person. It's like for everybody in this room right now. It's when you leave here, who is the person that has access to your cell phone that goes, when are you going to give up this dream of being a writer or a director or a producer? You know, your brother's a doctor. Your sister's a lawyer. When are you going to give up? And you got those uncomfortable Thanksgiving and those uncomfortable holidays. And I learned to not share my dreams. And so I put a message in the film to say, you know, somebody that didn't live their dream. I don't have any regrets. Like in my life, I lived all my dreams and I'm continuing to live my dreams. I just, you know, now strive for new dreams. But I think what happens a lot of times is that people get, like my kids call them frenemies. Where they're your friend, but they're really your enemy. So they can throw stuff on you by not even, like this says, so you're in the screenplay competition? You? And that one little you will go like, I'm insecure. Oh, I don't know if I'm the right. I don't know if I have what it takes. Oh my God, I'm exposed. I'm not good. Oh my God, I'm full of oh Lord, get me out of here. No, we need the dreamers. We need people. We need people with vision, people that are artists to be born.
Talk about Meteor Man for a little bit.
Meteor Man. My nephew was a little, I was living in LA and I would go to Chicago and he had to be like 5 or 6. And it was around, not Thanksgiving, it was close to Halloween. And I was just being an uncle, like going, you know, who are you going to be for Halloween? You know, you want to be Superman, Spider-Man? And he says, I can't be them because they're white. And I was like, he was so aware, like little kids. Yeah. I never watched television or movies with a prejudiced eye. I loved everybody I saw. I was just like, I love acting. I love directing. I love producing. I watched different things. And so when he said that, it really messed me up. And so then when I went back to LA, I said, you know what? I want my next movie to be about a superhero. I'm going to create a superhero. And I want the real theme of the movie to be about, you know, you have courage inside of you. It's not really about superpowers and all of that, but he's going to have superpowers. And then, you know, I just started thinking about, I watched all these superhero movies and I said, I'm going to do different things that will be different in the movie. And so one of the first things I did was I said, you know, like, you know, Superman flies high, everybody flies high. And so in Meteor Man, you know, I gave him, he's scared of heights. And so he only flies 4 feet off the ground. And so you see this guy flying and he's like 4 feet off the ground until he gets courage to go to the highest, the next level. So I just really, you know, and part of it was like growing up on Danny Kaye movies, like the court jester and the pestle is the thistle from the thistle at the pestle, you know, and I used to love all that silliness. And I said, okay, I'm going to add elements of that as I create this world. And then I called every celebrity I knew, from Luther Vandross to all the hottest groups back then, Naughty by Nature, you know what I mean? And so, you know, but I had the best time, but I just wanted to do something different and create something I thought was special. And, you know, people still love the film to this day.
One of my favorite parts about Meteor Man is that his power wanes from time to time, but he still has to kind of bluff his way through those moments.
What I wanted to do was, it's like, you know, like there's no real superheroes, but with Meteor Man, he got a chance to live at another altitude with his powers.
Are you all right?
I'm using steroids.
You know, that accident I had, I was hit by a meteor.
A meteor?
And it gave me these powers. Don't tell anybody about this.
Tell anybody? The whole neighborhood saw it.
Ma, just make up something. Just make up something.
But I really wanted to drive home the message of that courage for everybody and life is inside of you. You know, you just got to really sometimes fight through it. That's a lesson in show business. That's a lesson, you know, in relationship, in life, job, whatever, you know, but it's like to always have courage.
You're listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We've been hearing from independent filmmaker Robert Townsend.
Townsend co-wrote Hollywood Shuffle with friend and fellow stand-up comedian Keenan Ivory Wayans. Wayans would later go on to create and host the Emmy Award-winning comedy series In Living Color. The irreverent Fox series went on to launch the careers of Wayans' siblings, Damon, Kim, Sean, and Marlon, as well as featured cast members Jennifer Lopez, Jim Carrey, and Jamie Foxx. Comedian John Merriman spoke with Keenan Ivory Wayans at the 24th Annual Austin Film Festival. Clips courtesy of Samuel Goldwyn Company and United Artists Pictures, Inc.
How did you go from being an engineering student in Alabama to pursuing stand-up? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, see, this is a great example of life. If you embrace life and just let it take you, you will end up where you're going. So what do I mean by that? So I grew up in New York, in New York City, Manhattan, and I had finished high school, and I wanted to be a comedian, but I had no idea how. I didn't know anybody in show business. I didn't, you know, I lived in the projects, no idea. And my uncle was working with historically black colleges, and he said, well, why don't you, you know, we weren't even talking about show business. He said, you should go to college. And I hadn't really been thinking about going to college. He said, well, just apply and see what happens. So I applied. I took the SATs, and I did good. And I got a scholarship to go to Tuskegee. And while I was at Tuskegee, I was one of the only few guys from New York City. And what I would do is at lunchtime, I'd be on the fountain telling all these funny stories about New York. And I'd be doing all these characters and making people laugh, and every day people would gather around, and it was, you know, my time. And one day a guy came up to me, and he was from New York, and he said, you know what, when you go home, you should check out the Improv. And I was like, what is that? And he said, oh, it's where Richard Pryor started. That was all he had to say. And that was the beginning of my figuring out how to do stand-up. So it took me going 2,000 miles away to Tuskegee, Alabama, to find out about a comedy club that was literally 1 mile away from where I grew up. So that's life.
Legend has it that on maybe your first or second time out, that's when you met Robert Townsend?
Oh, Robert Townsend, that's my, like, you have a in this business, you'll have your day one, like right. The first friend you make. And I went that night to the Improv, and there's a line, you got to get in line and sign up, and I saw like a little furry afro, and I was like, oh, there's a, you know, somebody like me, and you know, and I went over and said hello, and we've been friends ever since.
You went on to work with them on Hollywood several
Shuffle
projects.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about getting to know him and how you came to work as a writer with him on Hollywood Show.
Like I said, Robert and I, that was like my first friend that I met in show business. And, you know, that's the guy that you have all your dreams with. I mean, we didn't have money back in those days, and we would walk literally from one comedy club to another. So the Improv was on 44th Street. We'd do a set there and then walk to 76th Street to catch a rising star. And as we walked, we would just talk about all the things we wanted to do one day. And we moved out to L.A. And after about a couple of years of the Hollywood Shuffle, we decided, you know, Robert said he wanted to direct. And I was like, yeah, you know, you should. And he was like, but, you know, we don't know anything about making movies. I was like, yeah, but we know, you know, we know enough to do something. So he decided at first we would do shorts. And so Hollywood Shuffle really was written kind of in reverse. So we did what we knew, which was the sketches. We did that first. And then we got enough sketches, we realized, oh, we might have a movie. Right. And then we sat down and wrote the story for the movie. So like I said, we kind of did it in reverse. And the truth was, we didn't know how to write. We didn't know how to write sketches. The way we, again, this is if I'm going to, like, have a teaching moment. This is like a lesson in just doing what you know, right? So don't worry about what you don't know. Just do what you do know. So what we did, we were comedians. So we set up a video camera and we laid out different articles of clothing. And each one represented a character. And we just improvised. And then we would watch what we did. And the stuff that we thought worked, we wrote it down. And then we would improvise some more. And that's how we wrote the sketches. Neither one of us had ever taken a writing course or anything. But like I said, we went with what we knew.
That's really cool. I mean, it's such a unique way to write. Talk to me a little bit about getting that movie going. I've heard that there were, he was, you know, buying up like bits of film that people had discarded.
This is like when you grow up with nothing, right? You like nothing is, that's just part of your existence. So you don't worry about that. You just, your mindset is always problem, solution. Because if you get stuck at the problem, you don't have anything, you know? So that was sort of how we approached everything. It's like, what's the problem? Okay, let's find a solution. And one of the problems is film. And film is expensive. You guys have, you know, iPhones now and, you know, stuff that really kind of democratizes making movies. But back then, you know, to get a can of film was like $10,000. So what Robert did was we both knew, okay, so when you shoot on film, there's something called short ends. And that's when the reel is about to run out. Rather than run out in the middle of the scene, the director will usually stop a minute or so before and change the film. And then they throw out that minute. So Robert went to the film house and asked them if he could have those minutes. So he just collected a minute, and the movie literally is shot a minute at a time. So you'd be in the middle of your scene like, hello there, cut. Oh, all right, I'm gonna go back. So we made the movie just like that. But that's what I mean. It was all, you know, problem solution. So permits, we didn't have permits. Again, a bunch of kids from the projects, you put somebody in a corner, he whistles when the cop comes, and you throw everything in the van and go, you know? So it literally was that kind of, you know, the whole shoot. But again, we didn't, it's great when you're too dumb to know you can't do things. You know what I mean? It's like we thought we could fly. We didn't know.
It's a hysterically funny movie, Hollywood Shuffle, but it also has some really biting cultural commentary, a theme that's gone throughout all of your work. Do you find that comedy is a better medium for that kind of thing when you're dealing with big social issues in some ways?
I do, but I have to be honest. Our intention, you know, we didn't go in thinking we wanted to make this huge statement.
Right.
We ended up making this huge statement. Our goal really was just to make a movie, and sort of the universal forces kind of guided us to that outcome.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI, we'll be back in a moment. listening to On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. Keenan Ivory Wayans created, launched, and hosted the groundbreaking 1990s sketch comedy series In Living Color. The often controversial show helped introduce a number of African-American comedians to superstardom. When we left off, Wayans was discussing the importance of writing what you know.
We were writing what we knew and talking about our experience. So once it was, you know, on film, you realize your experience is commenting on something, you know? I mean, we were very proud of what ultimately came out, but like I said, our intention really was to just make a movie.
And you're writing about yourself.
Yeah, you're writing about our experience in, you know, in Hollywood and in life, you know, some of the, you know, Jerry Curl had nothing to do with anything, but, you know, that was just a something that was really popular back then that we that we wanted to make fun of.
Right. Talk about the reception of that film. I mean, it blew up in a big way.
Well, it was, you know, it's funny because when we finished the movie, there weren't a lot of places that wanted the movie. They didn't get it. And we ended up at the Goldwyn Company, and Sam Goldwyn, he was independent. And he definitely had vision. Mm-hmm. Because at the time, there hadn't been a black movie in the marketplace for 20 years. It was the end of the exploitation era, and then there was nothing, literally nothing. So it was a real kind of learning curve just for how to sell the movie. And I remember, like, he wanted to cut out the Jerry Curl right. stuff because he was just like, I don't know what that is. You know, and I just, I think it's 10 minutes of people just going, what is that? And I said, so we negotiated with him and said, okay, let us at least keep it in for one screening. Right? And he said, okay. Well, the first screening was in Oakland, California, which at the time was the home of the Jerry Curl. Right. It was like, and when that scene came on, it was like somebody put a bomb in the movie theater.
You looking for me, punk? You must be Jerry Curl. Yeah, how'd you guess? I need to ask you some questions about Cookie Head Jenkins.
I don't know nobody named Cookie Head Jenkins.
And don't be coming around here asking for me no more.
Jerry Curl had won the first round, but it wasn't over. I was gonna make him pay. Not for kicking me in the stomach, but for dripping activator all over my suit.
People literally were jumping and running down the aisles, and so, you know, he obviously realized, oh, well, this resonates somewhere, you know? Yeah. The thing was, there was such a drought that people just, they came out. And I said this to the guy. I said, just imagine if there hadn't been a white film in 20 years, you know? I was like, people going to come just because. Just to see themselves. It doesn't. Right. We don't have to be good. We just have to be there. That's it. And you know, thank God it was good. But you know, it was like I said, there was just like nothing.
And I imagine it was a big hit on home video. I mean, I know that's me and my friends would rent it.
And you know, the other thing too is that, you know, when Robert and I were coming up, all of our early work was part of a renaissance that was starting to happen culturally. So, you know, I was lucky enough to be there at the very, very beginning of hip hop. Like, I remember coming home from school and walking past a record shop, because they had those back then, walking past a record store and hearing the Sugar Hill Gang. And like stopping in my tracks, because I was a kid who used to go up to Harlem and hear the DJs and go on the boat rides and hear the DJs and the, you know, the MCs. And I'm just like, is this on a record? Like, you know, like that's like, it went from something that was, you know, like underground to a record. It was like that. I cannot express like what a milestone that was, because we never in a million years ever thought that things that we were doing on the street was going to ever make it, you know, into mainstream. So I remember stopping in my tracks and walking into the store and just looking at the record. Like I'm watching it spin and I'm just looking at it. And in the next 3 minutes, there were like 100 other kids standing next to me doing the same thing, just looking at the record. Like it was, like I said, I can't even like put that into words. So that was that, you know, groundswell was starting to happen, and our culture was starting to become part of that generation's culture. And so on that wave came Hollywood Shuffle and Spike Lee and In Living Color. And so America as a country was starting to just consume, mm-hmm. you know, African-American culture in a different way. It was an interesting time.
Well, you talk about being there at the beginning of hip hop, and obviously there were African-American comedians, but you were at the beginning of this, mm-hmm. I mean, like you say, this new movement, and you started with meeting Robert Townsend, probably, yep. and then you start kind of assembling this team. David Alan Greer, mm-hmm. You guys met him through Hollywood Shuffle?
Yeah, all the guys were guys we auditioned with and, you know, struggled with and, you know, did the comedy circuit. And so, yeah, that's what networking is. So I tell people all the time, networking is not you trying to talk to me. Oh. No. What I mean by that is that if you're striving, right, your networking is not going to be through me, someone who's already gotten there. That's not how you want to network. The way you want to network is her. Who's right next to you? Yeah, it's like, no, I'm saying like, who's next to you? So you're a writer. What young aspiring director do you know? You know, because it's going to be that's going to be your. I know. No, but I'm saying it's like that's going to be your collective. It's like he was just saying, like you build your team, and the thing is that you're not even consciously building your team. You guys are just all dreaming together, and when you harness that, then dreams happen, because you know everybody is going to put that same effort into whatever the dream is. And that's sort of, like I said, that's the kind of networking that I try to encourage and people.
What that reminds me of is you guys were writing Hollywood Shuffle before you knew what you were doing, in a way. I mean, you were just making these characters,
right.
And then
it's
very organic.
Yeah. And the thing is that, is like I said, life, as long as you're moving forward, you're going to get somewhere. You don't know where, but you're going to get somewhere, right? If you take off walking today, you're going to get somewhere. So the thing is that as long as you are going, so do stuff. That's it. It's like, don't sit, just do stuff.
So after Hollywood Shuffle, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucker.
Mm-hmm.
Wrote, directed, starred in. That's a lot to do.
Yeah, well, it didn't seem like a lot because I had just saw Robert do it.
Right.
So, again, that's the other thing. It's like, you know, it's like my family, you know, people go, well, all your siblings are in show business. And that's because they saw their big brother do it. So the moment you see somebody you know do something, it becomes less mysterious. So the idea of writing, directing, and starring, well, I was like, oh. I've seen it done. It can be done. So I didn't see it as a monumental task.
Now, what I heard about I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, for anyone who doesn't know, it's a hilarious send-up of blaxploitation movies. I heard it came out of you just cracking up your friends watching these old movies.
No, actually, those are the movies that I grew up on. The idea for the movie came up from, sitting around my friends, but my friend was Eddie Murphy. So Eddie and I and a few other guys were sitting around laughing about these movies. And Eddie said, somebody should do a parody of these movies and call it I'mo Get You Sucker.
Never has a film moved so many and touched so deeply. United Artists is proud to present I Am Going to Get You Sucker, a captivating story.
Yo, baby, hold it. That ain't it. It's I'm Gonna Get You Sucker.
Yes.
And it's the story of the brother's fight.
Yes.
Against Mr. Big.
Yes, well.
Let's get that sucker.
Push.
It's about action. Bravery.
I'm a soldier, man. I've been trained for combat.
Let's do it. Back it around.
Romance.
12 inches.
And danger.
If y'all step on my bunny, I'll kill both of you.
I'm gonna get you, sucker.
I called him up and I said, are you going to do anything with that idea? He was like, nah, I was just messing around. I was like, okay. I said, well, I'm gonna run with that. He was like, go ahead. And then that's what I did. I sat down and I wrote, I'm going to get you sucker.
And what did you learn from that experience? I mean, the first time in the director's chair.
Wow. I learned that the director's job is to remind everyone that it is his movie. What happens is when you make a movie, you have all your different departments, right? You have your production design, wardrobe, hair, makeup, and everyone thinks it's their movie. And so literally, a makeup person can put makeup on somebody for 12 hours if you don't stop them. Because they're artists and they want perfection. And so as a director, you have to keep the ship moving. You have to keep reminding people. Your cinematographer, they will light and keep lighting and keep lighting. And you have to say, hey, man, you know, if we don't actually shoot this, no one will ever see this beautiful lighting, you know? So that's a director's job, is to keep all of these artists focused on a singular vision. That's it.
Is that when Fox approached you about...
Yes, after I'ma Get You Sucker, I got a meeting at Fox. Well, actually, I screened the movie for all the movie side of all the studios. And I got a call from Fox TV. And at the time, I didn't want to do TV. I wanted to do movies. There was a snobbery around back then about television. And so it really was. It was like people didn't do TV. They didn't do commercials. They didn't, you know. So I was being a snob. And they asked me to come and take a meeting. So I took a meeting. And I said to them, I was like, you know, I appreciate it, but, you know, I'm not trying to do TV. And they said, well, look, you know, we're a new network, and, you know, unlike the other networks, you know, we will let you do anything you want to do. You know, you can't tell a comedian you can do anything. So I tested them to see. And you know, to their credit, they really did allow us to do... Not everything we wanted to do, but they did allow us to push the envelope. And again, that wasn't the intent. The intent really was to be as funny as we could possibly be. And, you know, the outcome was pushing the envelope. You know, I didn't realize how conservative America was because I didn't grow up in America. I grew up in a... Yeah, like a world within a world. So when I stepped into the world, it was a real shock. I was like, really? People get upset about that? Like, you know, so that was a real learning moment.
How did it come to be? I know you, I've heard David Alan Greer say that there was a tape that was going around before it was even called In Living Color that you guys had made.
Well, we shot the pilot. And then it sat for like a year because they were nervous about it. And this was I had a meeting at Fox that to this day I swear it was like the Men in Black or some. So I had this meeting at Fox with the regular executives, and then a group of guys came in, all suits, very kind of, like I said, Men in Black. Like they had no expressions, nothing, and they just sat. And I'm talking with Barry Diller, and, you know, he's talking to me about the show, and he said, you know, we've tested the show, and, you know, it tested really well. And then they started talking to me not about what people thought was funny, but how they felt. So they were talking to people about how the sketches made them feel. I was like, wow, that's heavy, man. Like, you know, and then they asked me, they said, so tell us what your vision of the show is. And I said, well, you know, I think the show will be fun and, you know, revolutionary. And the guy goes, revolutionary? He said, seriously, he said, revolutionary. Tell us what you mean by that. And I had to, like, calm him down. Like, no, I don't mean revolution like that. I mean, like, you know, comedically revolutionary in that, you know, people haven't seen it before. And then after that meeting, they called and said they were going to air the pilot. And then, like, a few weeks before they wanted to air the pilot, I sat down with Peter Chernin, and they wanted to take out a bunch of stuff. So they wanted to take out Men on Film and Homeboy Shopping Network and, and The Wrath of Farrakhan. So, but what he said was they were nervous and that what they wanted to do was kind of slowly introduce the material to the audience. And that he thought that it would have a better chance for success doing it like that. And I said to him, I said, you know, I appreciate you guys, you know, wanting to give the show its best launch, but that's not my mindset. I said, I want to kick the door in guns blazing and whatever happens, happens. I don't want to try to trick the audience this week to think it's the nice Negro. And then and 3 weeks from now, I show up, you know. I said, let's just go for it. I said, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I'm fine with that. He said, okay. And then the rest is history.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, Texas Library and Archives Commission, and by a grant from Applied Materials. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan, as well as our associate producers, Aaron Halligan, Colin Heyer, Sonia Onescu, Maya Perez, and Brian Ramos. Our production coordinator is Ava Mikes. Editing help from Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance, KUT 90.5 in Austin. Go to austinfilmfestival.com to find out more about the Austin Film Festival and Conference in October. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.